The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to The Spectator's food and drink podcast, Table Talk. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And we're delighted today to be joined by Patrick Jefferson. Patrick is a consultant, journalist, broadcaster and New York Times bestselling author who is based in Washington, D.C. From 1988 to 1996, Patrick worked first as Princess Diana's equerry and then as her private secretary. He is also currently a historical consultant to the award-winning Netflix series The Crown. Patrick, welcome to Table Talk.
Great to be here, Lara. Thank you for having me and Livy.
Patrick, we're going to start where we always do, at the beginning, and ask you, what are your earliest memories of food?
My earliest memories, I suppose, are of going on holiday to the northwest of Scotland. Although I was born and brought up in Ireland, my mother was from Stornoway in the Outer Hebrides. Some of my happiest memories are of going up to the northwest coast of Scotland, near the town of Mallaig. And for a real treat, my mother would get lemon sole, more or less straight off the boat, and fry it for us. And that to me was both quite grown-up food, but it was delicious. And I've never eaten fish that tasted quite as good as that. And it was the freshest, and it was beautifully cooked. And the funny thing was, because it links quite well to my second memory of food, which was going to school. And the rule there was you had to eat everything. This was a Scottish boarding prep school. And you had to eat everything you were given. You could ask for a small helping, but you had to eat it. And the worst thing we had to eat was the school fish. And so the contrast between my mother's wonderful lemon sole and the school fish is probably, it's more than a memory, it's more of a trauma, I suppose.
And growing, just to take you back slightly, growing up in Ireland, what were mealtimes like in your family?
Well, they were a little bit, I mean, they were happy a lot of the time, but my mother died when I was quite young, so that rather ended that chapter of happy family mealtimes together. So after that, they became more like running feasts. And we had a lovely big kitchen where my brother and I, we learned to cook there. And we cooked principally for our own enjoyment. And we used to, I can remember, enjoy, he and I would give dinner parties for our friends and enjoy all of the logistics of planning it and cooking it and the fun of getting out the best silver and glass and really making an occasion out of it. And that combination of fun and food has stayed with me ever since.
And what kind of things would you serve at those dinner parties?
Well, we made a bit of a, well, my brother made a speciality out of venison. We had a herd of deer there, and every year they had to be culled. So there was an old family tradition of eating a lot of venison. The freezer was full of the stuff. And in the olden days, we had an ancestor, a great-great aunt, who liked her game really high, and she had a pit in the kitchen garden where the carcasses would be buried until they were decayed enough for her enjoyment, and then she would cook them when they were really, really stinky. We didn't go to that extent, but we learned lots of different ways to make venison, which can be rather a tough meat, really tender. We experimented with some really original marinades and had a lot of fun with that. I think the guests enjoyed it. We made sure that there was plenty to drink, so the food was almost incidental, but they were great fun, and we went as much for quantity as quality. We always made sure there was lots of everything.
You studied at Cambridge. What was food like when you were there?
Well, I was at a college that was not famous for its kitchen. First college I applied to, Peterhouse, was famous for its food. And one of the reasons I applied there was because it was the food there was legendary. It was so good. But unfortunately, I didn't get in there. So I went down the street to Pembroke. And Pembroke, bless it, did not have the same endowment for the kitchens that Peterhouse did. So Food in hall was not especially enjoyable. I remember there was a kind of weekly fixture of ragu. And ragu seemed to be whatever they found at the back of the fridge that week. We were lucky, though, because right next door to the college, there was a real old Cambridge institution, Fitzbillies Bakery. And Fitzbillies has been there for, I think, at least 70 years, maybe longer. And I'm pleased to see it's still going strong. And Fitzbillies pies, and especially my favourite, were their custard tarts. Absolutely fantastic. And the other great place to eat that certainly my friends and I enjoyed very much was a little restaurant, long since gone, sadly, called The Whim. And The Whim was, I think, theoretically a Greek restaurant because their staple dish was moussaka. And no matter what kind of a day you were having, a Whim moussaka would always set you straight. And quite often a Whim moussaka would be the foundations on which you could spend a whole evening drinking Green King beer. And the moussaka would see you through. There was a theory that at the beginning of every term, a truck of moussaka came to the Whim and unloaded in the backyard. And every now and then they would go out and take a shovelful of it for the day's menu. But the other wonderful thing you could get at the Whim was donuts. And no two Whim donuts were alike because each one was made by hand. So there were these wonderful irregular donuts, but they were always deep fried to a wonderful dark golden brown with lots of sugar. So they were crunchy and sweet, and you never knew what shape you were going to get. A plate of Whim donuts and the Sunday papers and lots of coffee was a great way of spending your Sunday morning.
And after college, tell us about how your career began.
Well, actually, I should mention that I spent time in Jordan digging on an archaeological site. And that, to me, was my first real introduction to foreign food, at least as eaten by foreigners. And I formed a lifelong love of a lot of Arab cuisine. There was a particular favourite dish there called makluba, which actually translates as upside down. So it's a bowl and you put cauliflower and meat and rice and tahini sauce, and then you turn it out on a big dish. So it's like a pyramid with cauliflower at the top and meat and rice. And that was a real special favourite, cooked by the cooks at the archaeology site. But the thing that got us going in the morning was stale flatbread with Marmite. And even if it was cold and horrible in your digging trench that morning, Marmite was something that I now associate always with cold desert mornings and lots of hard manual labour. after Cambridge, I went into the Royal Navy. I was on a naval scholarship at Cambridge. And so from then on, food was the way the Navy wanted it, the way the Navy cooked it and served it. And by and large, I really enjoyed it because we started off at the Dartmouth Naval College in Devon. And to begin with, the Navy runs you ragged. You get very little sleep and lots of exercise. So you're constantly ravenously hungry. And I remember the big treat halfway through the morning, stand easy, was great big cheese rolls. And to this day, a cheese roll is one of the biggest treats I can give myself. They were devoured. It was just fuel, all the calories you could get. You burned them off in no time. I wish that was still the case. And of course, being Devon, as soon as we were allowed out of the college, once we were given some leave, you could go into Dartmouth, a beautiful little town in South Devon. I mean, it's a real foodie haven. Now, even then, it had some lovely restaurants. And my favourite ice cream parlour, still there, called The Good Intent, where you could get double Devon ice cream with a big blob of double Devon clotted cream on top. and a Cadbury's flake. And that, to me, was the ultimate sinful indulgence.
Sounds delicious. And tell us how you ended up working in the royal household. Did you go there from working in the Navy?
Well, yeah. I mean, I served in the Navy. Well, they paid me for about 14 years. So from Dartmouth, of course, then going to sea, where food in a ship is a very important part of morale. And particularly when as we were quite a lot on a long patrol, and you might be somewhere cold and stormy, as we were a lot of the time, the food became a real high point of the day. And the chefs, key people in ensuring that the sailors were happy and that the ship was efficient. We had a tradition in the wardroom of having movie nights with an old projector, you know, with lots of reels of film. And these became quite important occasions. And I remember one night we were going to show the film Gandhi, which I think is 5 or 6 reels long. And so between each reel, when we changed reels, we had a different kind of curry. So it was a proper curry night. We were watching Gandhi, we were eating curry, and I remember it was particularly stormy. There was a big gale blowing, and the ship was rolling all over the place, and the projector kept falling off the table. So we had to lash the projector to the table, and we were happy there eating our curry and watching the movie. It sort of sums up how important food was for us then as a kind of... mealtimes were an occasion for really bonding with your shipmates. And we would always have a special dinner when we left port, when we left Plymouth, maybe to go on a deployment. We would have a dinner called Down Channel Night, where we'd all put on our best mess uniforms and the chefs would cook something really special. And of course, it's... sister was the up channel night coming home, when we'd have a particularly riotous evening celebrating the end of our long voyage. So food was important, and I would add maybe drink was too.
You were clearly, prior to that, a very competent cook who really enjoyed cooking. Was that something you missed? I mean, you went through years at Cambridge and then Navy College and then the Navy itself, where you're presumably not doing a lot of cooking yourself.
I carried on cooking during when I was on leave. Always enjoyed arranging dinner parties and, you know, the fun of it, the social aspect. My repertoire didn't improve very much. I got quite good at making bœuf bourguignon was one of my specialities. Bolognese, spaghetti bolognese, I'm still very good at that. It continues, the recipe continues to evolve. And chili con carne, really good hot chili or a hot curry. I suppose it's kind of blokey cooking. I never followed a recipe book, just throwing stuff in and mixing it and cooking it for a nice long time and seeing how it came out in the end. Nothing you could call really that required much finesse. But I do have the ambition of learning perhaps to one day to make pastry or cakes. That could be the death of me.
And tell us, Patrick, what was life like when you started working in the royal household, particularly from a kind of food angle?
Well, anybody who has the privilege of working for the royal family has the great good fortune usually to eat well too. I mean, there are many perks to the job. There are quite a few major obligations and sacrifices too. But the food was an important part of the job. I took a close interest in the food we had, because, you know, being a sort of an amateur foodie myself, even if not a very technically accomplished one, the food to me was important. The work, particularly, I found working for the Prince and Princess of Wales, and then after they separated, for the Princess alone, work was pretty stressful and pretty relentless. And anybody who can remember that time, or who cares to look it up, will see that we were headline news pretty much every day. There was always some kind of drama going on. Very unfortunate, obviously, for Charles and Diana themselves and their family. So a lot of stress, some very long hours, but great opportunities too. And for me, as Princess Diana's first and, as it turned out, her only private secretary, that's like her chief of staff, I had a wonderful free hand to set up her organization, to run her office, and plan her program. And that way, I not only had a hand in how Kensington Palace, her apartment there, ran its catering arrangements, but also on things like overseas tours. We had wonderful opportunities for trying different cuisines. And in fact, my interview for the job was over lunch. I had been on the ship out in the Atlantic with 200 hairy sailors for weeks on end, and suddenly I was summoned to Kensington Palace for interview for the job of equerry. And the interview was lunch with Princess Diana, just me and her lady-in-waiting. And the contrast from being in the frigate 2 days earlier and suddenly being sat at this little table with the most famous, beautiful woman in the world was pretty surreal.
I can imagine. What did you eat? What was the meal?
It was, and I can remember it very clearly, it was chicken in a white wine sauce with perfectly chopped little green beans and perfect little royal, Jersey royal potatoes. And so I thought, I was told I was not going to get the job. I was just one of six candidates. I was there, there were two candidates from each of the armed forces. I was just one of the Navy guys sent to make up numbers, I thought. They said, well, you're not going to get the job because you're not tall enough, you're not handsome enough, you're not rich enough. And anyway, it's the Army's turn. So I thought, okay, well, at least I'm off the ship for a couple of days. I'm going to enjoy this. And I'll never meet the princess again. I can tell my grandchildren I had lunch with Princess Di. So I'll tell you, Lara, I had a stiff gin and tonic before the lunch and thought, I will just enjoy this. And maybe because of the gin and tonic or because I wasn't under any kind of burden of expectation, I did just enjoy the lunch and enjoyed chatting to the princess. And so I was rather surprised on my way back to the ship to be called up and asked if I wanted the job. So from there, that was 2 years on loan from the Navy as an equerry. And then after the prince and princess separated, or actually rather slightly before they separated, Princess Diana asked me to leave the Navy and become her full-time private secretary. And she said, Patrick, we're going to go conquer the world. So nothing like aiming high.
And what was she like to work for? Would you often dine with her, or was there quite a kind of clear delineation between sort of who would eat with who in the royal household?
Well, the bigger household, Buckingham Palace, certainly at that time was a very stratified organisation. Everybody had their own dining rooms. The dining room for me as a senior member of household was very nice. It was a great perk of the job that every day there was this wonderful lunch in the bow room in Buckingham Palace overlooking the gardens, which was served you helped yourself from a buffet, but it was quite grand, quite palatial. But in reality, because with Diana we were starting a new organization, we didn't have a lot of people, we worked very hard, so a lot of my time was spent on the road. For every royal visit, every royal engagement she did, we would do what we called a recce, a planning visit beforehand. So I suppose royal eating for me was a combination of feast and famine. You might spend a whole week doing recces all over the country, eating nothing but British Rail sandwiches. And then you might spend another week going to state banquets or fabulous formal meals, where the food could be very, very special, but you were always on duty, so you couldn't properly relax and, you know, get your nose in the trough the way you might want to. You were always on duty, always on parade, which had probably a very therapeutic restraining effect. One thing I particularly remember was that the nicest thing with Princess Diana and meals on engagements was that when I did the planning visit, people would say to me, what would the princess like to eat? And I would always tell them, she would like to eat what you want to give her. So what does your chef want to cook? What do your catering team enjoy serving? What are the other guests going to enjoy? And that way, everybody was happy. The chef got to cook what he liked the most. Everybody else liked it. And Princess Diana, of course, although she had an eating disorder, which she largely overcame through her extraordinary self-discipline and sheer courage, I would say. Nevertheless, you know, she joined in the occasion. And that was a source of great job satisfaction for me at the end of a long day's engagements, to feel that everybody had had a good time and that, yes, the food and drink had been part of it.
Are there any of those state occasions that particularly stick in the mind?
Well, that's a really good question. They were all memorable for different reasons. The ones at Buckingham Palace I would say, reliably had lovely food, and especially the wine, especially the reds. Gosh, the claret that they served on those occasions was extra special. One of my favourite meals from that whole chapter of my life, there was actually on a recce. We were in France and dealing with the French government protocol office. As you can imagine, they were the Olympic champions of protocol. They were fantastic to work with, a real joy. And one of the most pleasant parts of it was we had lunch in their office dining room in the Quai d'Orsay. And you can imagine that it was a splendid occasion, wonderful surroundings, very, very discriminating fellow diners. And I remember we had pheasant, but it was extremely well done, and the wines, of course, to match. So, Livia, I would say that it wasn't always the grandest meals that were the most memorable. It was the happiest. And they could be really, really very unsplendid. I remember one of the most enjoyable breakfasts I had was in Nepal, in Kathmandu, in the foreign office there, where quite modest facilities, but wonderful hospitality, simple things done really well, and a great sense of welcome. And I suppose that's a lesson in a way. You can have the most fabulous meal in the world, and if you're not happy, or you're not with people whose company you enjoy, then you're miserable. Whereas what I learned, this was the feast and famine bit. Sometimes the famine was more fun than the feast.
And Patrick, when it comes to protocol and the hierarchy and the relations between different people eating at important occasions, what was your experience of that?
Well, part of the planning visit, the recce that I did before a royal event, was to find out what they were planning to serve, particularly the supplied overseas, where there were big diplomatic implications for the success of formal entertainment, the state banquet, for example. And it was all too easy, if you weren't careful, to cause offence, quite unwittingly. So I was always very conscious of this and finding out what the hosts wanted to give the princess, understanding national dishes, things of historical significance, things that the hosts would appreciate a diner enjoying. And very often the result was a triumph for diplomacy, but might nevertheless still leave you a bit hungry when you got back to the residence. So when in doubt, when dealing with food, unfamiliar food or food where there were diplomatic protocol implications, it was very important, obviously, to be seen to be eating it and appearing to enjoy it, whatever it was. And there were a great deal of importance was attached also to where you sat. The princess, obviously, on the top table with her host, but people like me, the lady in waiting, had to be within eyeshot. And so we could make sure that we could monitor how the meal was going, not just in terms of the cuisine, but also the accompanying discussions and conversation. Was everybody happy? Was this a bonding event where British diplomatic interests were going to benefit from the way in which the meal was conducted and the way in which people were seen to participate and enjoy it? But very often on those occasions, there would be a table at the far end of the room, usually reserved for perhaps security or embassy personnel who all were there to work, but who were not part of the main theatre of the meal. And this table was known by old tradition as the bludger's table. A bludger being, in Australian slang, a social security scrounger. So these were people who were at the banquet, but were not main players, but were nevertheless going to enjoy a really nice meal as part of their duties.
And were there ever any kind of diplomatic sort of faux pas that you can remember where something was brought out that perhaps didn't look so delicious to eat?
No, everything was delicious by definition. The important thing was, as I say, to make sure that everybody felt that they had got what they wanted out of the occasion. And there was one place we were in the Far East where during the planning visit, one of our recce team had eaten a nut, a local nut that had given him a violent tummy upset. In fact, he threw up in the back of the embassy minibus, which was most unpopular. But on the day of the big banquet, the same chap spotted on the table in front of Diana a little dish of these nuts. So he was very concerned about how to warn her not to eat any of them, which he tried to do with sign language, which was not very successful.
Did she end up eating one of these nuts?
No, she got the message. So did everybody else. That was the trouble.
Oh.
Patrick, you must have obviously got to know the Princess of Wales very well and seen her perhaps when she was sort of more in a kind of relaxed environment. Did she ever get the opportunity to cook for herself, or did she ever sort of enjoy cooking? Or I imagine she must have had a lot of food cooked for her, but was there a sort of another aspect to her where she liked to cook for herself?
I never saw her cook for herself. She had a great chef at Kensington Palace, so never really had to. But I did hear tell that she helped with cooking, particularly when she went to stay with her mother at her mother's cottage in Scotland. And she was very discriminating in her appreciation of meals. I remember one event was a concert given by Pavarotti, Luciano Pavarotti, the great Italian tenor, in Italy. And it was in aid of the charity War Child, which was helping refugee children from during the Yugoslav Civil War. And it was a headline lineup, really terrific musicians he'd got from all over the world. And the stage was a wonderful classical Italian building. But behind the scenes, what you might call the green room, all the performers had been given their own tent. And there was a village piazza in the middle of all the tents. And on the piazza, Pavarotti had his own pasta chef cooking up fabulous Italian dishes. So all the big stars of the concert were able to mingle informally in this sort of village piazza, eating fabulous pasta and talking. And several of them said that that was so different from normal big concert arrangements. And I was another of those occasions where I felt very, very lucky to be there. And it was the food that made it so special. Nida loved that. She loved pasta. I mean, her favourite London restaurants, I suppose you'd have to begin with San Lorenzo in Beecham Place. That was, again, not, I would think they would claim, the most haute Italian cuisine. Very nice, but mostly it was comforting. It was friendly. It was welcoming. She would meet friends there, or we'd go there after an evening engagement. She did say that she cooked good pasta. I never saw the evidence of it, but she certainly enjoyed eating it.
Speaking of comforting, what for you is comfort food?
You mean as well as a whim moussaka?
Whim moussaka followed by a plate of donuts aside.
Yep, that would be a pretty good comforting
mixture.
Sounds
pretty comforting, yeah.
I do like pasta. In fact, probably the best meal of my life was in Florence. Pasta with white truffle. A bit expensive for comfort food, probably. I would have to say it would probably have to involve bad carbohydrates in quantity. To pick at random, I would say Irish mashed potato with Kerrygold butter.
Yum.
Leave me with that and I'll feel very comforted.
And Patrick, you now live in America. Has that changed your attitude to food, or have you picked up certain habits whilst living in America?
Well, I have the good fortune to be married to a girl from Mississippi. And in fact, my wife's family live in New Orleans. So I spent a lot of time in the Deep South. And if you haven't been to New Orleans, go there, because it is legitimately, I think, the food capital of America, if not the world. It is a wonderful place for anybody interested in food. And if you think of some of the sort of stuff you can get there, like gumbo and jambalaya and shrimp etouffee. And my favourite, a thing called eggplant Napoleon, which is slices of eggplant grilled with cheese and crawfish cream sauce. Really fabulous Creole food. So whatever, whether it's sweet or savoury, you can absolutely indulge yourself in New Orleans. Perhaps the whim donut equivalent is beignet. You know, they're little sort of parcels of like donut pastry with sugar. You have a plate of beignet at Café du Monde with a big pot of chicory coffee. And that's real New Orleans.
And a smooth drift of icing sugar.
That's it. And then later on, you can go to the Roosevelt Hotel to the Sazerac Bar and drink Sazerac cocktails until it's time to go to the French Quarter.
We went there on honeymoon, and you've just brought it all back. I want to go back there now.
Well, I've missed Elf a lot, I know, but you get the idea.
And in the UK, we're now hopefully leaving the third COVID lockdown. How has, if at all, COVID affected the way that you eat where you are?
Well, Livia, I'd have to confess that the way I eat is probably too much. I've definitely got a bit of COVID spread going on, which I'm going to have to get to grips with. We eat more at home. America is very well organized in food delivery, for example. And so it's all too easy. You know, half a dozen restaurants close by, all of whom deliver, all of whom do delicious things. My current, temptation that I can't resist is barbecue. There's quite a new barbecue place here called the Black Hog. And Black Hog smoked brisket is just one of the most delicious things. Fork tender, beautifully smoky, and you have that with potato salad or what they call southern greens. And I'm happy, far too happy with that.
Sounds delicious. And just to finish on, Patrick, we like to ask our guests for what their desert island meal would be. What would yours be?
Okay. It would probably have to be pasta from Pavarotti's Pasta Kitchen. I could probably survive quite a few years on a desert island like that. I would probably sink the rescue boat when I got injured. but I would be happy.
Patrick, thank you so much for joining Table Talk. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Libby. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink Podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.